Chapter 62. Robber Barons. Many of the greatest American fortunes, including those enjoyed today by some of the most respected and influential families in the world, were based on terror and corruption. The original Vanderbilt, who began with a borrowed $100, was so ruthless that he masterminded a war which smashed the government of a foreign country where his interests were threatened. And when his favourite son died, leaving $200 million, the family was so scared that the body might be snatched from the 11-acre mausoleum that they hired a night guard who was ordered to punch a time clock every 15 minutes. The first millionaire Rockefeller, son of an itinerant peddler of patent medicines, was denounced by a congressional investigation as having attempted one of the most gigantic and dangerous conspiracies ever conceived. He was so hated that at the peak of his power he was hanged and burned in effigy. Again, the single-minded greed of the founder of the Astor dynasty, who was one of 12 children fathered by an obscure village butcher in Germany, was largely responsible for a series of murders. He also swelled his fast-growing fortune, which was to establish him as the richest man in America, by trafficking in opium. In the spectacular heyday of hell-raising America, when life was cheap and honest politicians were as rare as hen's teeth, these were the men who crushed all opposition and clawed their way to the top. They were the robber barons. John Jacob Astor, born on June 17, 1763, in the small German village of Waldorf, was the first and probably the most remarkable of all of them. His descendants are today regarded as the cream of society on both sides of the Atlantic. Royalty is proud to regard them as friends, and indeed the Duke of Edinburgh agreed to be the godfather to one of the Astor children. Their style of life has become a byword for elegance, and their influence stretches around the world. And yet, this whole amazing dynasty was founded by John Jacob, the butcher's son, who arrived in America in 1784 with exactly £5 in his pocket. New York in those days had a population of less than 300,000. What is now downtown New York was open, pleasant countryside, with barely a scattering of farms. But the city itself was filthy. Pigs rooted around in the garbage, which was strewn across the streets of even the better residential areas, and families got their drinking water from public pumps at street corners. But to John Jacob, after the backwater of Waldorf Village, this seemed the most exciting place on earth. He could never have guessed then that, thanks to his efforts, his family would later be described as the owners of New York. He was not afraid of work, no matter how hard or unpleasant, and at first he kept himself by peddling cakes and cookies through the foul-smelling streets. Soon he progressed to a more lucrative and far more odious task, beating the bugs and the dust out of furs. And for this he was given $2 a week and his board. It was not long before his employer was sending him into the wild country north of Albany to trade with the Indians, bartering tobacco, cheap cloth and jewellery for musquash and otter and beaver skins. There were immense dangers, for much of the territory was occupied by hostile Indians, but John Jacob, whatever his faults, certainly did not lack courage. He was not a man, though, to be content to remain an employee, and realising the vast profits which could be wrested from the fur trade, he began trading with the Indians on his own account. Most men in the fur trade at that time hired middlemen to deal with the Indians, for they considered themselves to be gentlemen, and that the work was too dirty and too dangerous. This was where John Jacob had a great advantage. Having been brought up in the blood and mess of a butcher's shop, he had no illusions about being a gentleman, and he was prepared to do anything if the rewards were high enough. Other dealers, lacking the tenacity of John Jacob, dropped out of the fur trade because of the obstacles deliberately organised against them by the British. The British, furious over their defeat at the hands of the former colonists, had passed a law which meant that all furs bought in their territory, which included Montreal and most of the frontier posts, had to be sent straight to England before being shipped back to New York. John Jacob, a genius at buying cheap and selling dear, persevered. His profit margins were reduced by the infuriating double journey across the Atlantic, but by persistence and slogging hard work, he became one of the most powerful fur dealers in New York. And then in 1796, the law was changed. Furs bought in Canada could be sent direct to New York, and within 4 years, only 16 years after his arrival in America, John Jacob made his first $250,000. His empire began to flourish at a tremendous pace, and the more money he acquired, the more he wanted. All the fur traders were completely unscrupulous in using liquor to swindle the Indians, and John Jacob became the master of the alcoholic bargain. His agents operated their own stills, making the semi-lethal drink at 5 cents a gallon and selling it to the Indians at 50 cents for a small bottle. And they got the Indians so befuddled that the pelts were virtually given away. At one stage, John Jacob not only got his furs for nothing, but was actually owed vast sums of liquor money by the Indians. But because of John Jacob, later described as a self-invented money-making machine, hundreds of white men were treated even worse than the Indians. Workmen employed by the traders, who in turn were dependent on John Jacob, were being hired for $100 a year. He considered this was far too much, although the work was so arduous that many of the men died before completing their contract, and he insisted that in future the rate should be $250 for 3 whole years. The traders, however, were kept almost permanently in John Jacob's debt because of the astronomical prices charged them for supplies, and sometimes they had their workmen murdered just before payday, thus reducing the wage bill. Bribery was also used as an empire-building tool for the semi-literate John Jacob. He once wrote to President James Monroe, "It may not be convenient to repay me the sum lent to me, nor am I particularly in want of it." But instead of returning of his cash, he did expect favours, and he got them. Monroe delegated the authority for dealing with all complaints against John Jacob's company to Governor Lewis Cass of Michigan Territory. And although there were plenty of complaints, Cass never took any action. A sum of $35,000 was paid to him by John Jacob's company, although the services were never specified. It was not long before John Jacob had so much money that he could hardly remember what life was like without it. And it was in all seriousness that he once told a friend, "A man who has $1 million is as well off as if he were rich." But the really big money came from diversification. He bought a share of a ship, then a whole ship, and finally a splendid fleet of ships. And with these ships, he launched a scheme which everyone else considered to be financial suicide, to open up the Far East as a market for his company's furs. The British East India Company dominated trade in that area. But somehow, and there were rumours that more bribery was involved, John Jacob won their permission to take his vessels into any of their ports. And those vessels returned to New York with cargoes which were even more valuable: tea, spices, silk. All of this would have made enough profit to satisfy 10 ordinary tycoons, but not John Jacob. On the return voyage, his vessels called for food and water at the Hawaiian Islands, where sandalwood was cheap and plentiful. For nearly 20 years, thanks to his initiative, he held the monopoly of the sandalwood trade. From the Asiatic port of Smyrna, reputed to be the birthplace of Homer, his ships also picked up vast quantities of opium. The fact that people were encouraged to destroy themselves with the drug was of little interest to John Jacob. There was money in the trade, and that was all that mattered. A typical example of his cunning was seen shortly before the War of 1812, when an embargo imposed by an uneasy government kept all American ships locked in New York Harbour. Astor sent a Chinese mandarin, Peng Chua Wing Chong, to the New York officials with an appeal for him to be allowed to return home for the funeral of his father. The appeal went to the president, who agreed that in the special circumstances, Peng Chua Wing Chong could have special dispensation to sail on the ship Beaver. John Jacob's competitors were furious when he started loading the Beaver, his own vessel, of course, with a vast consignment of furs. But he pointed out that it would be ridiculous to send a large vessel on such a voyage to carry just one Chinese gentleman. And anyway, the president had personally approved the sailing. Due to the inflated prices the shortages helped him to charge, the round voyage earned John Jacob nearly $250,000. However, the vast bulk of John Jacob's fortune came through the soaring values of land in and around New York. One of his first major killings came in 1809. Through a characteristically crafty deal, he gained over 51,012 acres of Putnam County. The land had been taken from Roger and Mary Morris during the American Revolution because they were Tories. Astor discovered that, technically, the government had no legal right to confiscate the land, for the Morrises had only held a lifetime lease on it. After their deaths, it was to go to their 3 children, and it would be illegal for the children to suffer because of their father's political mistakes. Old Mrs. Morris was still alive, but John Jacob ignored her, and he traced her children to England, where he persuaded them to sell their eventual rights for about $100,000. He then waited until the death of Mrs. Morris, who, to his annoyance, lingered on to the age of 96, before revealing his master strategy. 700 families had bought farms on the land from the New York State government, and John Jacob sent each of them a notice of eviction. They had improved the land and built houses, barns and cottages, but in law they were trespassing on his property. The state had to step in and buy him off, so giving him a fantastic profit. Another example of the money-spinning art of John Jacob came in 1804, when a neighbour, the American politician Aaron Burr, shot his rival Alexander Hamilton in a duel and then had to flee the country. It was John Jacob who provided him with enough money to make his escape, in return for the lease of a huge tract of land. That land is now Greenwich Village. Mortgage foreclosures ranked high in his system. That was how he acquired Eden Farm from an impoverished whiskey distiller. Relatives of the distiller later disputed the legality of this action, and he bought them off for $9,000. The farm later became Broadway, from 42nd to 46th Streets, and has been valued now at over $20 million. There was just one bitter disappointment in the life of John Jacob Astor. His first-born son, John Jacob II, was born mentally defective, and for some time had to be confined to an institution. But there was another son, William Backhouse Astor, who inherited the bulk of the fortune and who had a flair for making the money grow. A curiously coincidental sequel to this tragedy was seen in the story of the first Vanderbilts. Cornelius Vanderbilt I, born into a long line of Dutch Vanderbilts who grew vegetables on Staten Island, also named a son after himself. Like John Jacob Astor II, Cornelius Vanderbilt II was also locked away for a while in an asylum. He was an epileptic and a tremendous disappointment to the old man. But here again, there was another son called William, just as in the Astor family, and it was he who eventually proved as financially astute as his father. Old Cornelius Vanderbilt, known for most of his life as the Commodore, was born in 1794. And when he died at the age of 83, he left a fortune of $105 million. He was a flamboyant six-footer, a hard-living, hard-swearing man with incredible energy. He was almost a fanatic about his diet, and his standard breakfast was a lamb chop, the yolks of three eggs, toast, and a mug of tea into which he carefully counted 12 lumps of sugar. After fathering 12 children by his first wife, he eloped with a young girl. He was then 75. But no one was unduly surprised. The Commodore could always be relied on to do the unpredictable. When he was only 16, he persuaded his mother to lend him $100 to buy a two-masted sailing barge in which he could carry produce around New York Bay. She insisted on him earning the loan by ploughing, harrowing and planting 8 acres of the family's farm within 1 month. Soon he owned 3 ferries, and he often worked 24 hours without sleep. A year later came war with Great Britain, and a British fleet was menacing New York. The American Commissary General asked for bids to transport supplies to military posts around the harbour. Cornelius Vanderbilt's bid was accepted, and, as he was prepared to take risks which frightened off other operators, he quickly prospered. In 1849 he secured a charter from the Nicaraguan government for a water route across the Isthmus of Panama, using it to transport thousands of 49ers from New York to California. Like Astor, he too began to diversify, and pretty soon he established himself as America's first great railroad king. The Nicaraguan exercise provides one of the best insights into the ruthlessness of the Commodore as a robber baron. In May 1853, he took his family on a grand cruise to Russia, England, Germany, France and Italy, in his luxury 270-foot-long steam yacht, the Northern Star. And while he was away, two of his associates in Nicaragua, Charles Morgan and C.K. Garrison, misused their power of attorney to rob him of his rights there. After his rage had subsided, he dictated a letter which gave a clear insight into how he operated. It said, "Gentlemen, you have undertaken to cheat me. I will ruin you." Shortly afterwards, a man called William Walker from Nashville, Tennessee, arrived in Nicaragua with a small invading army of Nicaraguan exiles. There was a little fighting before the country's president was deposed and replaced by one well-disposed to Morgan and Garrison. His friendship, of course, was encouraged by bribes. But the new president died shortly after assuming office, and William Walker became president. He too favoured Morgan and Garrison in their fight with the Commodore, and so the Commodore launched his own private war against Nicaragua. He somehow managed to persuade four neighbouring republics that it was in their mutual interest to organise a defensive alliance against the regime of President William Walker, and he even arranged the formation of an invading army. Walker was defeated, and the Commodore, who now wielded vast influence in Washington, urged that the Marines ought to be sent to Nicaragua to protect American interests. They did, and once again, the Commodore had won. When he died, he left $90 million of his fortune to his son, William. By the time William died, only 8 years later, he had transformed that inheritance into more than $200 million. It's intriguing to note how, with the robber barons, the patterns seem to have repeated themselves. Old John Jacob Astor, for example, towards the end of his days, suffered from such an acute stomach disorder that he was able to digest only human milk. A wet nurse had to be found for him. Many years later, the same diet was ordered for another man whose surname has become a synonym for wealth, John D. Rockefeller. Rockefeller, born in Richford, New York, in 1839, started his business career, as Cornelius Vanderbilt had done, with a loan from his parents. His father, William, was a glib and unreliable character who had to disappear from home for a while in 1849 after being charged with raping a servant girl. William earned a precarious living as a travelling peddler of quack medicines which could cure cancer and every other ailment from baldness to ingrowing toenails. However, in 1854 he was sufficiently in funds to be able to lend John $1,000 at 10% interest. There was, however, clearly a streak of generosity in old William, for he did say that if the interest was paid regularly for 3 years, then he would consider the $1,000 a gift. John, like the original millionaires Astor and Vanderbilt, was pitiless with himself in pursuit of money. He worked himself to the limits. He was also pitiless with others, for he saw success as being in control of a complete monopoly. By the time he was 38, he controlled 95% of all oil pipelines and refineries in the United States, and behind him was a trail of ruined men. His Standard Oil Company flourished, and one of his major aims was to wipe out all refining competition in Cleveland. By doing a complicated deal with the railroads, he organised a conspiracy which would have smashed the smaller companies out of existence, unless they cooperated with him on his terms. He was the major customer with the railroads in the area, and so with them he could call the tune. Through a corporation called the South Improvement Company, he made contracts with three railroads, the Erie, the Pennsylvania, and the New York Central, under which they agreed to jack up the freight charges for the smaller independents to a prohibitive level. They also agreed to carry Rockefeller's oil at a substantially reduced fee. This would enable him to undercut any company which refused to throw in their lot with him on his terms. It was all legal piracy of the most blatant kind. Anger flared throughout the oil business. Rockefeller became the most detested and reviled mogul in American history, and his effigy was hanged and burned. The Pennsylvania legislature was forced to rescind the South Improvement Company's charter, and a hurriedly convened congressional investigation denounced Rockefeller's efforts as one of the most gigantic and dangerous conspiracies ever conceived. 7 years before Rockefeller was born, another American called Israel Thorndike proved conclusively that in the rough-and-tumble grabbing after riches, there was a great deal to be said for real piracy. He never climbed anywhere near the league of the Rockefellers or the Vanderbilts, but he did have the distinction of becoming the first millionaire in New England. He made his money as the captain of a privateer, and he took many rich prizes. These were invested in the risky manufacturing ventures of Massachusetts and New Hampshire, leaving a phenomenal $1.5 million when he died in 1832. The Rockefeller story might well have been different if a man from Scotland called Andrew Carnegie had been more successful in the Great Western Pennsylvania oil rush. For Carnegie, who later went on to control two-thirds of America's steel production, would certainly have been a powerful rival. And it's impossible to speculate on which one would eventually have won domination. However, Carnegie did little more than to flirt with the oil business. Carnegie started his career in the classic American way, as a 14-year-old messenger boy with a telegraph company. He moved on to become a private secretary to a top man in the Pennsylvania Railroad, and eventually he was appointed as superintendent of the Pittsburgh division. With money saved from his railroad salary, he bought his way into a company building iron bridges, and then he joined three others to form the Union Iron Mills. After 2 years of the partnership, he managed, by shrewd wheeling and dealing, to take control of the mills. He kept on telling his partners that the business was about to sink and that he was thinking seriously of selling out. And finally, one of them became so worried by Carnegie's gloomy prognostications that he did sell out, not realising that he was selling out to a stooge planted by Carnegie. An insight into the toughness of his character was provided in April of 1892, when he summoned his general manager to his New York mansion and gave him a signed notice which was to be displayed for the benefit of all the employees at Carnegie's Homestead Works. It said that in future no member of a labour union called the Amalgamated Association of Iron and Steel Workers would be employed, and it was intended to pave the way for a wage-slashing campaign planned by Carnegie. Then, having landed the general manager, Mr. Henry Frick, with his unpleasant task, Carnegie hurried off for a holiday in Scotland. This plan to wipe out the union provoked such a backlash that 300 guards from Pinkerton's National Detective Agency were called into the Homestead Works. Men were maimed and injured in savage gun battles, and more than 40 Pinkerton men were almost torn to pieces. State troops were called in, and 163 men were seriously wounded. 14 of them died. The outrage threw the nation into turmoil, and most of the wrath fell upon Carnegie. He was savagely attacked not only for having given the orders which sparked the violence, but also for having hidden away out of the country while Frick did the dirty work. He was shot by an anarchist for his pains, but survived. Union leaders, of course, have often stated that their own jobs have been made much easier by the attitudes of men like Carnegie. The more brutal an employer was in his efforts to destroy the power of the unions, the more the men were aware of their need for a powerful union, and the harder they fought for it. The principle was clearly demonstrated in the Ford Company, when the management battled so hard to resist the march of the unions in the late 1930s. Henry Ford I, born in July 1863, was completely different from his grandson, Henry Ford III. He was a complex character, a curious mixture of humanitarianism and quite frightening harshness. He considered himself to be a benevolent and generous employer, and he would have been genuinely shocked to learn that he was considered to be ranking high amongst the most self-centred of the robber barons. In 1916, Henry I hired an ex-sailor called Harry Bennett, whose prime job was to act as a head of the espionage network which would keep Henry I informed of all the undercurrents in his factories. He formed his own private police force of wrestlers, thugs and college athletes, and it was their duty to beat up anyone who dared to do anything so evil as to talk about forming or joining a union. After being beaten up, the victims would then be fired for starting a fight. In May 1937, the nation was increasingly against union-busting brutality. Leaders of the United Automobile Workers got a permit from the city of Dearborn to distribute handbills in front of the Ford Rouge plant. Bennett and his hoodlums were waiting for them. They grabbed Richard Frankenstein, one of the key union men, and pulled his coat back over his shoulders so that he was unable to defend himself. They then kicked him in the head, the kidneys and the testicles. One of Frankenstein's colleagues was dragged down a flight of 36 iron steps, and another man had his back broken. And then the thugs turned on the onlookers, kicking women in the stomach, beating up journalists and smashing the cameras of the newspaper photographers. Eventually, because of battles over the question of union representation, Fords were found guilty of numerous violations of federal law. The Supreme Court upheld the convictions. After Henry II became president of the company in September 1945, the first thing he did was to fire Harry Bennett. An era of terror was finally over, and no one could ever again say that the Ford Empire was in the grip of a robber baron.